This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. The global hunt for who supplied Hezbollah with the thousands of pagers that exploded in Lebanon this week continued Thursday. Security sources say that Israel was responsible for the explosions that killed 12 people and injured thousands. It is not clear how and when the pagers were weaponized so they could be remotely detonated. Same question remains for the hundreds of handheld radios used by Hezbollah that exploded Wednesday in a second wave of attacks. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged restraint from France, where he was meeting with the French Foreign Ministry.
France and the United States are united in calling for restraint and urging de-escalation when it comes to the Middle East in general and when it comes to Lebanon in particular. We continue to work to get a ceasefire for Gaza over the finish line.
How and when and with whose help the pager attack was carried out was not yet known, although so far there were possible leads in Taiwan, Hungary, and Bulgaria. From Iranian hacking to Russian influence campaigns, the 2024 presidential campaign is now encountering a spate of efforts by foreign adversaries to weaken faith in the outcome and potentially alter the results. The Biden administration has moved aggressively in recent weeks to call out the operations in hopes of alerting Americans to remain vigilant to wide-ranging, often hidden foreign efforts to influence their positions on hot-button positions, as well as the candidates. The latest development has come Wednesday when U.S. officials disclosed Iran's unsuccessful attempt to shop information stolen from the Trump campaign to his political adversary. You'll find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. AP correspondent Karen Chalmers reports on floods in Central Europe.
A massive flood wave moving across Central Europe is threatening new areas and raising concerns among residents and officials. Heavy rains have also caused flooding and the evacuation of some 1,000 residents in northern Italy's region of Emilia-Romagna. The death toll is rising in Central Europe as receding waters reveal the extent of the destruction. The overall death toll in the affected countries, which include Czech Republic, Poland and Romania, as well as Austria, has reached at least 24, as European Union Chief Ursula von der Leyen expects to visit the region. I'm Karen Chamas.
The coming winter will prove the sternest test yet for Ukraine's energy grid since the beginning of Russia's invasion, according to the International Energy Agency's executive director, Fatih Birol.
Only a few weeks ago, there was a major attack from Russia, damaging big chunk of the energy infrastructure in Ukraine. So this situation is very delicate now, especially winter is coming. And even before this attack, because of previous attacks on the Ukrainian infrastructure, two-thirds of the power generation capacity of Ukraine was lost.
Artillery shells sold by Indian arms makers have been diverted by European customers to Ukraine, and New Delhi has not intervened to stop the trade despite protests from Moscow, according to 11 Indian and European government and defense industry officials, as well as a Reuters analysis of commercially available customs data. Venezuela's former opposition candidate says he was coerced into signing a letter effectively recognizing his defeat in July's presidential election. Electoral authorities claim that President Nicolas Maduro won that vote. Wednesday's revelation of the letter is a latest strain to the country's political crisis, which is exacerbated by the disputed election results and Edmundo Gonzalez's recent departure for exile in Spain. Gonzalez and the Unitary Platform Coalition he represented claimed they defeated Maduro by a wide margin. The document states it was meant to be confidential, but Jorge Rodriguez, head of the National Assembly, presented it during a nationally televised press conference hours after a local news outlet published parts of it. Colombia has suspended peace talks with the National Liberation Army, or ELN, after banning the rebel group for an attack that killed two soldiers and injured more than 20. Government's peace delegation announced the suspension of the dialogue process in a statement Wednesday. It is the deepest crisis of the peace negotiations with the ELN since November of 2022, and after the president, Gustavo Petro, took power as the first leftist president, launching talks with that and other armed groups under a policy known as total peace. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Former President George Weah may support Liberia's bid for a non-permanent seat on the UN Security Council, but with conditions.
The best thing for any Liberian to do is to look at the situation and if there are faults, to identify the faults. So he has given free advice to the government to say, here are the issues that you have to tackle for Liberia to become a viable candidate.
South Sudan church leaders criticized the extension of the transitional process. Uganda and Mozambique signed bilateral agreements to promote agriculture, trade and commerce. Turkey seeks to revive Ethiopia-Somalia talks.
Turkey is one of the biggest instigators of this conflict because Ethiopia's reaction and tension towards Somalia is largely because of Turkey's entry into Somalia. What Turkey wants to do is to reassure Ethiopia that they do not have a hidden agenda.
And South Africa is exhuming the remains of its citizens who fought against the country's apartheid regime but died in exile in neighboring Zimbabwe. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former Liberian President George Weah has officially responded to a request by President Joseph Boakai's administration to support Liberia's bid for a non-permanent seat on the UN Security Council for 2026 and 2027. Liberia will officially launch its bid on September 27 in New York. Earlier this month, Foreign Minister Cyril Bessalo-Nyanti asked Weah to do a minute-long video message endorsing Liberia's bid and to join in the launch. Weah's office responded on Thursday, saying that while he has always supported Liberia's aspiration for a UN Security Council seat, the country's domestic policy must reflect the values it seeks to promote globally. Eugene Nambe is the chief of staff of Weah's office and the signatory to the letter. He tells me that those values include good governance, promotion of political freedoms, and the rule of law.
To ask whether he will show his support behind the bid will insinuate that he has not. In fact, former President Weah is the progenitor of this idea that because of Liberia's own historical activities as a bastion of democracy in Africa, as the first independent republic in Africa, we play a very critical role in having all the sister countries get their own independence. And then because of our role in peacekeeping and generally in peace and security in the world, President Weah embarked upon a serious diplomatic sojourn that led to both the Economic Community of West African States and the African Union giving full endorsement to Liberia's bid for the non-permanent seat on the Security Council, which will happen in June of next year. So President Weah has been behind this whole initiative from the get-go. In fact, he started it and guided it to this far.
What exactly is going to be his role? What is he going to be doing?
He has already started his role. The best thing for any Liberian to do is to look at the situation and if there are faults, to identify the faults. So he has given free advice to the government to say, here are the issues that you have to tackle for Liberia to become a viable candidate for the Security Council's non-permanent seat. So he has started his job, and one of the greatest things that he has done was to give free advice to the government to point out the possible hurdles and show those indicators that could lead to the derailment of the bid. He has started his job already by first getting a commitment from ECOWAS, the endorsement from AU, and now he is still engaged with the process by pointing out all of the hurdles and potential hurdles that will stand in the way of Liberia becoming a member of the United Nations Security Council.
As I read your letter, you say that Liberia's internal actions must reflect the values that we seek to promote globally. Some might interpret this that you or the former president is conditioning his endorsement of Liberia's bid.
To the contrary, he's exposing those things that could possibly derail our bid for a non-permanent seat. And why do I say this? You know, for the commitments that were made to be actualized, Liberia itself must have a better internal and domestic policy, a policy that will ensure that we have respect for rule of law, respect for our democratic credentials, and political freedoms. So those are the things that we articulated, that if the government of the day does not pay attention to all of these things that are presenting hurdles in the way of our smooth bid for a seat on the Security Council, then that is the problem. And he's shining the light on those potential hurdles that could derail our bid. Instead of the government focusing on superficial matters, he is suggesting that they address some of these challenges domestically. Otherwise, those are the issues that will derail our bid.
Eugene Nambo is the chief of staff of former President George Weah's office and the signer of Weah's letter. He was speaking with us from Accra, Ghana. Uganda and Mozambique have signed bilateral agreements to promote agriculture, trade, and commerce. Above all, they agreed to promote peace and fight terrorism. In a related matter, former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, who is visiting Uganda, says African countries can use their comparative advantages to achieve economic integration. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakariji had more from Kampala.
Officials from Uganda and Mozambique met in Ugandan capital Kampala to discuss inter-country cooperation in agriculture, trade and commerce, as well as pressing for greater security. Ambassador Richard Kawanelo, an official with Uganda's Minister of Foreign Affairs, read the communique after Thursday's meeting.
The two countries reaffirmed their determination to work together to combat terrorism and transboundary crimes. They directed the technical officials to ensure full implementation of the concluded MOUs, defense cooperation, trade cooperation, agriculture, crop and animal husbandry, fisheries and agriculture, mineral resources and energy, oil and gas cooperation, and ICT by December 2024.
The two countries also agreed to ease cross-border movements by removing travel visa requirements. Many African nations have signed bilateral agreements to remove restrictions. Rwanda waived visa requirements for all Africans. On Wednesday, Rwanda and Liberia signed a cooperation agreement that promotes air transport, health, ICT, agriculture and mining, among others. In a related development, former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, who is visiting Uganda, said it is high time that African nations agree to remove trade barriers.
Whatever we are trying to do about integration in Africa, political, it will probably take much longer time than while I'm alive. But we can do something about economic. We can do economic integration. We can take advantage of large scale. And we can take advantage of comparative opportunities that we have.
Kamara Kankwatsa, a lecturer of international relations at Kampala International University, welcomes such developments. He calls it a step in the right direction.
You climb steps, you climb a building by taking the first step. So if two countries can have an agreement to cooperate in all these fields, then the next step is adding the third country, that agreement. And from there, then they have a regional bloc.
Several blocs, such as COMESA, EAC and SADC, were formed years ago to foster inter-country and regional cooperation in Africa. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
After the cancellation of a third round of talks between Ethiopia and Somalia that had initially been set to take place in Ankara on Tuesday, Turkey plans to meet separately with Somalia and Ethiopia as part of its efforts to resolve a dispute between the two sides, according to Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan. Edgar Kitua is an international security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi, Kenya. He tells viewers Douglas Umpuga that he is hopeful that Turkey could help resolve the dispute.
Turkey is one of the biggest instigators of this conflict because Ethiopia's reaction and tension towards Somalia is largely because of Turkey's entry into Somalia. What Turkey wants to do is to reassure Ethiopia that they do not have a hidden agenda, that they are not going to interfere with Ethiopia's military or with Ethiopia's hegemonic ambitions in the region. In other words, Turkey is just trying to reassure Ethiopia that it is not the enemy. It has not come to destabilize Ethiopia, because Ethiopia's biggest fear is that Somalia wants to use Turkey's military support and Turkey's military aid to block, number one, its access to the sea through Somaliland and to probably destabilize it in one way or another. So Turkey is stepping in as a big brother to try and tell them, we are not here to fight. We just want to establish our military base. We just want to be trading partners.
Do you think, in your opinion, Turkey can pull off what neighbors and the EU have failed to do?
It is highly possible because, number one, Turkey will fund the process. Turkey will bring money. The African Union does not bring money. The African Union brings in good offices, but Turkey has the potential to fund this. You know, it is easier to deal in a bilateral or trilateral meeting than it is when you're bringing in the summit and you're bringing in the AU and all those big guns. So it is possible. Turkey is a very influential country. And it will also bring goodies on the table. Part of its deal will tell Ethiopia, we will give you military aid, we will give you military support, we will support your hospitals. Because now Turkey has built one of the biggest hospitals in Somalia, it will tell Ethiopia, we will support you in healthcare, we will support your military. That is the kind of language that Turkey will bring to the table. And Ethiopia might decide to, you know what, reduce the tensions because it needs the military aid. It needs those assurances from Turkey.
Talking of tensions, Ethiopia does not only have tension with the Somalia, their relationship with their northern neighbors, Egypt, is not good. Does that help?
Now, let me tell you what might end up happening. Ethiopia might end up telling Turkey, look here, I have no problem with you being friends of Somali, but I also need you to back me up because of my tension with Egypt. Remember, Ethiopia-Egyptian relations are full of tension because of that dam, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, the GRD Dam. So when Egypt threatens Ethiopia and tells them, we are going to come and bomb the dam, we are going to come and destabilize you, this is a good opportunity for Ethiopia to reach out to Turkey to tell them, why don't you support us militarily, or why don't you defend us militarily? And do not be surprised if you see some new deal between Turkey and Ethiopia, and Turkey pronouncing itself that it is going to help Ethiopia protect that dam.
Edgar Getua is the international security and diplomatic expert at the U.S. International University in Nairobi, Kenya. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, September 20th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Ahead of our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Some religious leaders in South Sudan have criticized the transitional government of national unity for prolonging the transitional period for another 2 years, while others support it. For VOA News, Mayang David Maya reports from Juba.
The South Sudan Islamic Council says it stands behind the Kiir administration's decision to extend the transitional period for another 2 years. Ibrahim Denyikir, Information Secretary for the Council, says instability across the country justifies the extending of the transitional government for 2 more years.
It is reasonable and understandable that this decision can help to achieve peace in South Sudan and also then go back to war. We appreciate the consciousness and would like to appeal the parties to continue on dialogue and compromising the general will, country will, not their self-interest.
The South Sudan Council of Churches doesn't see it that way. It says the ruling elites in Juba have been reluctant to implement major provisions of the 2018 peace deal. The head of the Catholic Church, Cardinal Stephen Ameyu, told reporters that the transitional government has weak justifications for prolonging their stay in power.
All the reasons highlighted for this extension were all stated during the previous extensions. The church realized that because of lack of political will, all the key important provisions in the roadmap remain unimplemented.
Ilia Lomuro, South Sudan's Cabinet Affairs Minister and Secretary of the Committee monitoring the implementation metric of the 2018 peace deal, says the government is serious this time around.
Whatever money is given to us, we'll implement those provisions that are either in progress or outstanding because of funding constraint. And we will be reporting to the presidency on a monthly basis, as we said earlier on, to make sure that an issue that arises is addressed head on.
The reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or RJMEC, a body monitoring the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement, voted Wednesday on the decision to extend the transitional government for another 2 years, which also postpones this year's scheduled election. Archbishop Moses Deng of the internal province of Western Barilgazal in the Episcopal Church of South Sudan says some religious leaders would like to engage political leaders about what will happen during the extended period.
I would request His Excellency the President to have a meeting with him as soon as it is possible on the side of the President before they can make any decisions.
South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa welcomes the extension and is pledging his country's support. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayer in Juba.
South Africa is exhuming the remains of citizens who fought against the country's apartheid regime but died in exile in neighboring Zimbabwe. Some of the exhumations are taking place in a region where many Zimbabweans were killed by the country's own security forces in the 1980s. As Columbus Mavunga reports, families of the Zimbabwean victims are hoping that their loved ones can also be removed from mass graves and given a proper burial.
The South African government is exhuming the remains of 50 citizens who were forced into exile by the apartheid-era government and died in either Zimbabwe or Zambia. Officials say the goal is to return the remains home for reburial and bring the families some closure.
It was in fact one of the recommendations of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the TRC, that there should be community reparations to communities that were severely affected by political violence. And the exile community is exactly one such community.
Nearby lie mass graves of some of the estimated 20,000 people that Zimbabwe's army killed during a power struggle in the 1980s. Advocacy group Ibrechu Likazulu says the victims remain buried while South Africa's government retrieves its citizens. Mbuso Fuzwayo is the group's leader.
It's sad because our government accepts that ANC must exhume, but Zimbabweans are not allowed to exhume their people. They are not allowed to speak. The government wants an outcome that suits or exonerates it. So at the end of the day, Zimbabwe is far from healing.
66-year-old Sipho Mutimukulu says his parents, brother and cousin were all killed by Zimbabwean security forces more than 40 years ago. He says he has waited for justice and reburial of his relatives, but he has given up as age wears him down.
What I want done is to see or hear the perpetrator himself. Just that is enough for me to be able to feel like the case has come to a closure. The government is now taking a new dimension on it, is roping in chiefs, but to me it's really not what I would have expected a government to do about this massacre.
Since coming to power in 2017, President Emmerson Mnangagwa has promised to deal with the issue of the massacres. His predecessor, Robert Mugabe, was in power during the massacres, but dismissed evidence of them as, quote, heap of lies. With music calling for peace and unity playing in the background, Mnangagwa said during a visit to Bulawayo in July that survivors would be interviewed and could get compensation.
Today is a pivotal moment in our history. This is the day where we demonstrate that as a country, we are capable of resolving our disputes as Zimbabweans, regardless of their complexity or magnitude.
As South Africa takes home the remains of the victims of its struggle for freedom, some Zimbabweans say they can't wait for their turn. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
The number of refugees and forcibly displaced people in Western Central Africa has doubled since 2019, reaching nearly 14 million, the United Nations Refugee Agency said on Thursday. The figure has climbed from 6.5 million refugees and internally displaced persons in 2019 to 13.7 million in 2014, according to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport in Cairo, where the draws for the CAF Beach Soccer Africa Cup of Nations Egypt 2024 was conducted on Thursday at the CAF headquarters. In Group A, Egypt were drawn alongside Morocco, Tanzania, as well as Ghana. Reigning champions Senegal, who have lifted the title a record four times, headlined Group B, where they will be up against 2022 hosts Mozambique, Malawi, as well as Doubleton, Mauritania. Khalid Nassar, CAF head of competitions, conducted the draws.
As you can see, the best eight teams have qualified to the final tournament. So now the group stage will start on the 19th and it will end on the 22nd. And then the semi-finals will be on the 24th and the third place and final will be on the 26th.
Staying with the Confederation of African Football, the continent's football governing body has announced the dates for the African Nations Championship CHAN Finals, which will be hosted by Tanzania, Kenya and Uganda. According to CAF President Patrice Motsepe, the tournament is scheduled to take place from February 1st to the 28th next year. Motsepe mentioned that the three host countries are currently preparing for the finals, which will feature players from local leagues in each country. He also noted that the first round of qualifiers will be played during the weekend of October 25th to the 27th this year.
The commitment and the passion of the heads of state, President Ruto, Madame Samia, President Museveni, this part of the world is going through an exciting period. And we are privileged that we can make a small contribution through football.
President of Nigeria's Wrestling Federation, Daniel Igali, has declined to seek re-election next year. The Canadian Olympic gold medalist noted that his decision was because of lack of government support ever since he was elected as a federation leader 12 years ago. Under Igali's leadership, Nigeria produced world-class wrestlers like Blessing Oborududu and Odunayo Adekunioye. In basketball news, Kenya National Basketball Men's Premier League champions Nairobi City Thunder has secured the services of three seasoned international players. The players will bolster their roster ahead of the new season that also has the highly anticipated road to the Basketball Africa League qualifiers. The trio are power forwards William Sidney Davis II of USA, Michael Dergoyev Diouf from Senegal, and American-Nigerian point guard Uche Urebu. In athletics, Athletics Kenya Youth and Development Director Barnabas Kurie believes the government of Kenya cannot let the country to sink into non-compliance with World Anti-Doping Agency regulations. His observation follows an alarm raised by the Anti-Doping Agency of Kenya after major funding cuts. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, September 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend, and we'll see you again on Monday morning.
Supreme Court's historic decision to limit abortion rights, there has been a wave of abortion-related policy shifts around the world, including in Africa. On this week's episode of Our Voices, we will look at the different perceptions and beliefs relating to sexual and reproductive health and the ongoing pro-choice and pro-life debates on the continent. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.